History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. One of the worst accusations you can make is traitor. This is the only crime specifically defined in the Constitution. And the term conjures notions of Benedict Arnold or hundreds of thousands of Civil War deaths and accusations that are increasingly being thrown around against political enemies today. In this podcast, we've done previous episodes looking at what actually makes a traitor. How is one man's traitor another person's patriot? How is Benedict Arnold a traitor and the Confederates a traitor when the Founding Fathers also rebelled against their sovereign government but are considered heroes today? And we've dived deep into these questions. Well, we're going to go even deeper into this episode. UC Davis law professor Carlton Larson is the author of the new book On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. And what he does is provide a look at how the law has historically been applied to the famous and infamous actions of people like John Brown, Tokyo Rose, Edward Snowden, Jane Fonda, and Aaron Burr, as well as forgotten cases of men like Hippolito Salazar, who was the only man executed by the federal government for treason since the end of the Revolutionary War, even though he wasn't an American citizen. So we're going to look at America's experience with treason law over the last 250 years and how it explains America's history when, in one sense, it was birthed from treason, how America's treason law is distinctive because of our unique history, whether Robert E. Lee and the soldiers he commanded should have been charged with treason, they weren't, and discuss whether this was the correct decision or the incorrect decision, it's a difficult one, whether the crime of treason against the state is common, and how Carlton would rewrite the constitutional clause concerning treason if he could do it any way he wanted to. Treason is not just a legal thing, it's also an ethical thing. When is it okay to rebel against a government? Most of us would agree that treason against a state like Nazi Germany is okay, but saying that it's okay for you to steal a Ferrari because you're fighting against the tyranny of capitalism, so it's not really treason, not a lot of people would buy that. So those are the two ends of the spectrum right there. Where do we find the middle and where is the dividing line? So not easy questions here, but I love getting into these gray areas of history, and we're going to get all into it in this episode, Carlton Lawson. Carlton, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to this topic because, as listeners of the show know, this topic on what defines treason is something that has come up in the past because we've seen that this is a complicated issue because people who are one man's traitor is another man's hero, as we saw with things like the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. And also a traitor is a term that can be thrown around loosely. Sometimes it is according to a legal standard. Other times you can throw it out to somebody who really doesn't live up to your own personal ethical standards. And sometimes those ethical standards can be very ambiguous and you're just throwing that term around lightly. But anyway, what is the reason that compelled you to want to research this topic in depth and write a book about it?
I got interested in the subject of treason when I was in college and I wrote my senior thesis on the issue of treason and the American Revolution. And then I continued research on that, which ultimately culminated in my first book, The Trials of Allegiance, Treason Juries in the American Revolution, which was published in 2019. And as a result of that, I just became very interested in the law of treason more generally, and I became known as somebody who knew a little bit about this subject. And so when we started getting lots of questions about the behavior of Donald Trump, I started getting a lot of calls from the media asking whether what President Trump had done was treason, or whether some of the accusations that he had made against others of treason were accurate. And so all of a sudden, the subject that I had worked on for a very long time, but which was fairly obscure for the most part, had suddenly burst into public conversation in a very big way. And so I thought it might be useful to try to distill some of what I had learned into a relatively short and fairly accessible book for non-lawyers that would explain just what treason is, what it is not, and how the law of treason has played out in American history.
Right. For better or for worse, it seems to have become bipartisan shortly after the beginning of the Trump administration it began, and then right before the election here, when people were saying that Hunter Biden was being this Chinese liaison or whatever for money coming in with Joe Biden, like this, it's thrown around all over the place now. And I really like what you're doing because this isn't a new thing. I mean, there's a long history, but it's good to see. Are there constants over at least the American Republic? Does the definition change over time? And so let's go back to the beginning, since you researched this area specifically in the revolutionary context, what was the understanding of treason in colonial America and then in the early republic?
So in colonial America, the governing framework would have been the English Statute of Treasons from 1351, which was a very important statute that sought to limit the crime of treason to a handful of defined offenses. And there's some debate as to what extent that was fully enforced in each of the colonies, but that would have been the sort of legal frame of reference that most colonial Americans would have approached the subject. And so there was a lot of debate in the years leading up to the War of Independence as to what was treason, and there were threats by the British to try various Americans in England for the crime of treason because of their resistance activities. And so the Americans insisted that no, we're not committing treason, we're simply exercising our lawful rights. And then, of course, the war erupts, and then you actually do have, you know, literal treason, levying war against the king, and then finally, of course, independence. And so at the end of that, with our Constitution in Article 3, the framers included a provision on treason, actually defining the crime in the document. So it says treason against the United States shall consist only of levying war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And so this was quite unique. It defines the crime directly in our Constitution, so it can't be modified by Congress. The English statute could be modified and was sometimes modified by subsequent English parliaments. But that's not true in the United States. If a crime can't be fit into this very precise constitutional definition, it can't be considered an act of treason.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the American understanding of treason, let's say from the founding of the Republic up until the Civil War. It's understood, and it says right there in the Declaration of Independence that if a sovereign violates the inherent rights of man, getting into natural laws as understood by Thomas Jefferson and others, then it is the right of the people to replace him with a new government because he's violated natural law. So treason, it's not this, there's an implicit contract between ruler and ruled. So already, do you see the way that Americans understand treason play out in the early republic that, okay, I mean, really, let's, at the end of the day, this is a contract, that this is what started our nation, and if we have to do it again, we will. It's not like there was a divinely ordained monarch like they believe in Europe. We have something different. Is this, do you see this ethos in America, or is it more in writing than in actual, the spirit of the republic?
Well, I think in the early republic, what you get a sense of is that, you know, the revolution was distinctive, and that we don't have just sort of a general idea that, you know, whenever people feel like it, they're frustrated with the government, that their proper resort is to arms. I mean, the Constitution itself empowers the federal government to suppress insurrections. And when we did have tax protests in the early republic, the Whiskey Rebellion and Freeze's Rebellion, the Washington and Adams administrations used military force to suppress them and then tried many of the leaders for treason. And some of those people said, well, hey, we're just doing what the revolutionaries did, you know, 20 years ago, by protesting what we think is of as unconstitutional taxation. But the response of the Federalists was essentially, no, that's not the way it works. You are now represented in this government. You send representatives to Congress. You can't argue taxation without representation. You're simply arguing a policy dispute where you don't like the way it came out. And the way to solve that is not through bullets, but through ballots. And you're not going to be able to simply try to overthrow the lawful laws of the country by force.
Do you think this explains a lot of the things that come up in antebellum America, like Andrew Jackson and the Force Bill not allowing South Carolina to ignore federal tariffs, or other episodes that you see in this period?
Yeah, so I guess it's not surprising that, you know, once the government is up and running, that they, you know, value internal security in the same that any government does, even if it has emerged from a violent revolution.
Right, exactly. So let's get back to the, I think one of the main cruxes of this discussion of treason is when we get up to the Civil War. I did a military history of it with a co-host. It was a very long series. And something we tried to point out at the beginning of the series is that it's easy for people to look after the Civil War that the South should have never embarked on it because they had no chance, and completely leaving aside the morality of their cause. What they were doing at the time was looking back to the Revolutionary War, that at the same time you have a enemy power that has an arms advantage, it has a technological advantage, but they're not fighting on their home turf. They're fighting their enemy on foreign soil. Their resources are stretched more thin. They have this disadvantage. And More importantly, those who are fighting for the right cause. They're fighting for the cause of liberty and for independence in order to govern their own affairs as they see fit. So, and what Confederates at the time were saying is, well, the founding fathers were considered to be traitors, and they're calling us that, but it's just the same story all over again. So from a legal standpoint, when the Civil War happens, how is this different from the Revolutionary War?
Well, in some ways, I mean, it's different. In other ways, it's not. I mean, one way it's not is that both the Americans fighting the Revolution and the Confederates were traitors. I mean, it's very clear that the Americans were committing treason against Great Britain by levying war against the king, and the Confederate states were levying war against the United States. So they were both committing treason within the regimes that they were initially part of. Now, we celebrate the American founders, of course, ultimately because they won, and ultimately because we think that the cause they were fighting for was worthwhile. And one of the arguments that they had was, of course, no taxation without representation. That is, we don't have any say in how the government of Great Britain is being conducted. Whereas by contrast, if you look at the history of the United States prior to secession, the Confederates had enormous influence in our government. They were overrepresented in the Congress because of the Three-Fifths Clause. They had a steady run of Southern slaveholders as president. They had a significant majority on the Supreme Court. They had won the Dred Scott decision, 7-2. There was a powerful Fugitive Slave Act passed in 1850. The presidents who were Northerners had generally been sympathetic to Southern slavery. And so they had, in some sense, had everything. And if anybody should have been upset in the years prior to the Civil War, it would have been the North, who potentially could have claimed that they were somehow being unrepresented. So for them to secede solely because Abraham Lincoln won the presidency seems very, very different in terms of sort of the underlying political structure than American colonists who were objecting to a series of truly oppressive British statutes in which they had absolutely no say.
Another factor, too, is whether Robert E. Lee and the soldiers he commanded should have been charged with treason. And I've done a number of episodes on Reconstruction. And as a contemporary issue, it's really come under the microscope by a lot of historians who think that the failures of it can explain a lot of the problems that we have today due to the failure to reconcile America and also to create a successful post-slavery order that would have integrated all Americans properly with the full rights of citizenship. But at least at the time and for a long time, Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee were commended for not making Reconstruction worse and not causing another Civil War, or at least a Cold War between the North and the South because of steps toward forgiveness. But it's a thorny subject. So what is your take on Robert E. Lee and Confederate soldiers and treason?
Well, Lee and the Confederate soldiers clearly were guilty of treason, and if they had been prosecuted for that crime, I can't see any real legal reason why they shouldn't have been convicted. But when Lee surrendered at Appomattox, he was essentially given very generous terms by General Grant, who more or less said, if you lay down your arms, you're free to go home, and not be molested any further by the United States, which was sort of seen as a promise that you will not be prosecuted for any crimes. And so, given that, it would have been hard to have gone ahead with the prosecution of Lee or any of the soldiers. The real issue was the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, because if you're going to prosecute anybody, it's going to be him. And you can't leave him unprosecuted while prosecuting anybody else. So that's the biggest and most important test case. And so Jefferson Davis is indicted for treason. He spends several years under indictment. Ultimately, the case fizzles out, and he's given a pardon by Andrew Johnson. And so we don't have, Jefferson Davis as a convicted traitor, which in some ways I think does affect our historical perception of him. Had that conviction happened, we might think of him in a somewhat different light.
Right. And then to actually jump back in time a little bit, somebody that has come up surprisingly often in this podcast is Benedict Arnold. And when we did a series on the Revolutionary War, I was really fascinated by him as this tragic figure where he really did seem to be the hero in his own eyes. And there are some Revolutionary War historians who the most pro-Benedict Arnold interpretation you can take is perhaps he really did think that it was for the best for the colonies to rejoin the British Empire, and perhaps that's why he switched sides. Now, the more common consensus view is that he was an opportunist, and he was also very prideful, and not getting the recognition that he thought he deserved in the Revolutionary Army caused him to switch sides. But that type of view on, because Benedict Arnold was called a traitor, and because he was on the losing side in the battle, that's why there's no Benedict Arnold high schools which there almost definitely would have been if he would have died at Saratoga. But for someone like Benedict Arnold, he's an interesting figure. I mean, how have you handled him in your research on this issue of treason?
Yeah, so I think he is sort of the arch-American traitor. I mean, he is the one name that is indelibly linked with treason more than anyone else. And I think he is a very fascinating figure for all of the reasons you mentioned, and his motivations are certainly tangled. And I think what makes him, particularly distinctive is there were lots of people who sided with the British during the Revolution, thousands of them, and many of them fairly prominent. So why do we remember him? Well, I think there's two reasons. One is he was by far the highest ranking in terms of probably being really sort of the second general only to George Washington in terms of his fame and his influence. And he had, of course, access to all of our military secrets. And then the second thing is he didn't turn coat until September of 1780. So this is over 5.5 years into the war. Whereas most of the other prominent Americans who went to the British did so very early, 1775, 1776, once they saw the way this was going. And so those people could say, well, they had an honest, honorable disagreement about what should happen, and they chose their side. Arnold turning so late in the war makes it much harder to think that it really was about an issue of principle. Now, it's possible that his view of the war had simply changed over time, but people at times said it was all about money. And, he negotiated hard with the British to try to get a lot of money. And it's interesting, some of the research I found, even sort of arch Tories were appalled at what Arnold did. They thought this was just disgraceful. Like, once you've picked your side, you really kind of need to stick with it. And so he actually wasn't warmly welcomed, particularly by the British when he came over. They viewed him as, a bit of a skunk. And, if he's going to turn sides once, what's going to stop him from doing it again? So I don't think he received anything like what he was hoping for when he did what he did.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. And this is an example that treason is obviously not just a legal matter, but there's also an ethical and philosophical element too. And I'll have some bigger questions on that, but to return briefly to the legal issue, one thing that you do in the book is discuss the crime of treason against a state. Is this a common crime?
No, it's quite uncommon. So during the Revolution, treason was a state-level crime because we just didn't have any operating federal courts. And we tended to think of the crime as national. People like Arnold were referred to as traitors against the United States. But actual prosecutions were done in state court, and the crime formally was treason against that particular state. And so after the Constitution was adopted, those state laws remained on the books. And as new states came into the Union, they tended to add state treason laws as well. So a majority of states have some law to the effect that it's treason to levy war against that state or to adhere to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Now, given that enemies is almost entirely a matter of foreign relations, I think that's preempted by federal law. It would be a federal treason if you aid our enemies, not state treason. But if you try to overthrow a state government by force and violence, and you don't also aim to overthrow the United States government, I think you could be guilty of the crime of treason against the state. And there have been sort of three noteworthy prosecutions in our history, several cases rising out of the Dorr Rebellion in Rhode Island in the early 1840s. Probably the most famous would be John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, that led to his execution and the execution of one of his co-raiders. And then finally, a series of cases in West Virginia in the early 1920s, where a sort of war had broken out between coal miners and representatives of the coal mining interests.
What was that case in the 1920s about?
So there you had essentially a group of thousands of miners massed in the hills of West Virginia who aimed to rescue miners who they thought had been improperly imprisoned. And the state of West Virginia responded by essentially providing a counter-military force, soldiers and even aircraft, and they fought, most notoriously, in a battle called the Battle of Blair Mountain, where we don't know the exact total death counts, but probably 10 to 20 people perhaps died as a result of this fighting. And when it was quelled, some of the leaders were tried for treason against West Virginia in the little courthouse in Charlestown, West Virginia, where John Brown had been tried about 60 years earlier.
In one other case you mentioned, I was really surprised, in Rhode Island in the 1840s, where there's two governments that claim to be the legitimate government of the state. I mean, this sounds like the Middle Ages, where there's a papal court in Rome, and then there's a papal court in France. So Rome is a lot, you know, it's got a lot more going on than I ever gave it credit for. So what's happening there?
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of those great stories that just is, I think it's an important part of our history, but it's certainly rarely ever taught in our textbooks. And that is, Rhode Island had its old colonial charter from the 1600s, and it never changed it after independence, which pretty much every other colony other than Connecticut had done. So it never got a new state constitution, and it divided political power up in a way that really entrenched a handful of wealthy landowners. And so there was essentially a popular referendum to create a new constitution called the People's Constitution, which was ratified, and people took office under this new constitution. But the old government insisted that no, we're the legitimate government of Rhode Island. And so for a period of time, you had two people, both claiming to be the governor of Rhode Island, operating under completely different constitutions. And this ultimately ended in violence, and the leader of the People's Constitution, the governor, Thomas Wilson Dorr, was imprisoned and then convicted of treason against Rhode Island for essentially, you know, running an alternative government and for levying war against the state.
I can imagine people trying to litigate goofy laws from the 17th century in that charter, such as, the Puritan minister will have the right to whip anyone who does not carry His Majesty the King James Bible in their household, or whatever that's
right. Going on.
Okay, so one thing with treason is that a thing that you wrote is that no person has been executed for treason by the federal government under the Constitution, but there was someone, Hippolito Salazar, who was executed by the U.S. government in New Mexico in 1847. So what is that story about?
It's really an extraordinary story, and it's one that I just became aware of shortly before the manuscript of my book was due, so I sort of got it in the nick of time. And what I had written, what every other person had written about treason law had said, was that no person had been executed under federal authority since the adoption of the Constitution for the crime of treason. Well, that turns out not to be true. So during the Mexican-American War, the United States conquered the Mexican region of New Mexico. And the American commanders on the ground announced that everybody living there was now an American citizen, that New Mexico was now part of the United States, and that anyone who resisted the American military would be guilty of treason against the United States. That was clearly not true. Territory doesn't become part of the United States just because the American military happens to invade. I mean, if that were true, then parts of Iraq became part of the United States in 2003, and that obviously doesn't make any sense. So some of the people who had resisted American authority were tried for the crime of treason. And one of them, Hippolito Salazar, was actually executed for this crime. And if you think about what this meant, it meant Hippolito Salazar was a Mexican citizen who was tried for the crime of treason against the United States on Mexican soil for betrayal of a country he had never set foot in. And he's the only person who has died as a traitor to the United States, and he wasn't even an American. Now, as word of this seeped back to Washington, D.C., members of Congress were utterly appalled. They realized that this made absolutely no sense, and the Polk administration had to admit that it had made a mistake. Yes, that technically Salazar could not have been guilty of treason. They said, well, he was a bad guy. He was a murderer. He deserved to hang anyway. But they conceded that, yes, as a legal matter, this was a mistake. And so it means that the only person executed for treason against the United States since our Constitution not only was not an American, but was conceitedly an illegal and unlawful execution.
All right, so we don't have a great history of litigating this. Yeah, for sure. One thing I want to just take a step back on and look at treason more as an ethical or philosophical matter. Listeners will have to bear with me here. I'm going to use an analogy not from history, but from Star Trek. So two of the greatest captains on the show, I think, are Captain Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek The Next Generation and Captain Benjamin Sisko from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Jean-Luc Picard is a deontologist, where the right action is the right course. Ethics are solid regardless of what ends will become, so he has the chance to destroy this alien species, the Borg, who are threatening to annihilate the entire Federation and all their characters, but he doesn't because he feels corrupting this person and even this other species is genocide. And the show I mean, it's the show really bends over backward to always make him right in the end, even though sometimes you have to bear with the cost of not being able to, you know, get into the gray zones and play dirty politics, whatever. The other captain, Benjamin Sisko, is a wartime captain. He suffers from the Borg. He is a consequentialist, where he leads during a time of war. He does things behind the scenes. He sanctions assassinations. There are false flag operations. But in the end, he saves billions of lives. So the show shows that ethics are great. And he does believe in higher principles. But in order, he does realize to a certain extent that the means justify the ends. So it's kind of interesting with this issue of treason. I imagine there's a lot of people who think that, all right, well, this particular nation state I'm a part of is saying this and that. So no one would really say today that if I were violating the principles of Nazi Germany, that you are a traitor to Nazi Germany. They'd probably say, well, that's a rotten republic, so we're not going to hold you to account because your order simply wasn't based on higher principles. But if you take that too far, then someone could justify any sort of law breaking that, well, it's okay for me to break into this Ferrari dealership because, man, it's a sign of capitalism and oppression, and that's my way to fight capitalism. And a lot of judges and other people probably aren't going to sympathize terribly for you stealing that Ferrari. So this is more of a philosophical matter, but I imagine you've seen these things from a historical perspective. So is there anything that jumps out to you from ways that you've seen kind of treason of the a way to mark that line between justified and unjustified pushback against the legal order under which you are? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a very difficult and profound question because it really goes to the heart of, you know, what all this is about. I mean, essentially, you know, every country has its own treason laws, and people who resist it in various ways are probably going to be found guilty. And so it's not so much whether a question of sort of, you know, internal law, whether these people are guilty or not, because they probably clearly are, but whether sort of in a larger sense, we might say they are justified. So, you know, when Locke talks about the right of resistance to arbitrary government, he says he ultimately, at the end of the day, you have to make an appeal to heaven, meaning an appeal to force and arms. You have to be willing to fight. And if you win, you will be looked on, for the most part in history, not as a traitor, but as legitimate. And so if you look through English history, you know, people say Henry VII overthrowing Richard III. Well, Henry VII won. So we don't refer to him as a traitor. We refer to him as King Henry VII. Had he lost, right, he would have been hanged as a traitor. And that's how we would remember him. There's, you know, a couple of famous lines of this, right? You know, if you strike at the king, you must kill him. A little more eloquently, Sir John Harrington's phrase, you know, treason doth never prosper. What's the reason? For if it prosper, none dare call it treason. Meaning there's no such thing as successful treason in our history because we don't call it treason if it's successful. So I think, you know, a big part of it is just ultimately, and this is perhaps unsatisfying as a philosophical matter, is, you know, did you win? And then perhaps also, you know, what was it you were fighting for will reflect on how you're viewed in history. But I don't know that that gives a whole lot of guidance to any one person on the ground who almost always is convinced that they are right, even if they're not.
Right. And that's a huge, huge, huge question here and not easy to be solved. I think the way that the word treason has just been thrown around in the future, hopefully, I don't know if we're escaping from the pandemic slowly in 2021, it's a better year than 2020. From your standpoint, because you study the history of the word treason, do you think that it's a do not break in case of glass word that unless we are actually talking about, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors or the legal definition, something that happens once in a multi-decade period, once in a century, then we trot that out. But don't just throw that out as a casual term. Or what's your take on using that in our discussions in the body politic?
Well, I think in general, you know, discussions of political issues would be much improved if we don't use the word treason frequently. I mean, I do understand why people sometimes use it colloquially, but it does have a distinct legal meaning. It's an accusation of a crime. It's a capital crime. If you think someone is a traitor, you really are saying they probably should be put to death. And my concern is that so many of our current political disagreements where we see people just shouting traitor at each other is that these are, you know, really ways of sort of demonizing and dehumanizing people on the other side of a political divide. And the fact that people have fundamentally very different views as to political issues doesn't mean that they are traitors. They may just be simply completely misguided or have erroneous views. And so to the extent that we can't see the other side as fellow Americans who simply are perhaps wrong, but as actual criminals who deserve to die, you know, that makes for a very poisonous politics. And so I would very much like to see, you know, the term not used as much as it is. Now, part of the problem is just given the very narrow legal definition of treason, there's a whole category of activities where someone has clearly betrayed the country. And it's I think betrayal is an appropriate term, but we don't have a nice phrase that captures that, short of traitor or treason, which then turns out not to be quite legally accurate. And so part of it is just, I think, a problem in our vocabulary.
Right. Okay, well, I really liked what you did with your book, where things that I've discussed on the show in the past, that you delved into way more detail. This is a legal issue. It's something that has changed over time, and it's influenced a lot of the ways that people have made decisions and believe they were fighting for a righteous cause and thinking history would be on their side. So really a lot going into this. And for listeners who want to check this out in more detail, the book is On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. Carlton, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.